Hello and welcome to Fantide, the podcast for all those complex and complicated conversations about the gray areas in our lives. I am journalist and writer Jared Hill.
And I am journalist and editor Travelle Anderson. Coming up on the show today, we're going to dive deep on the COVID vaccine with two Black medical professionals. But first, as you all know, Pass the Popcorn is our opportunity to discuss some of the things y'all are talking about on social media, or as this week is the case, not enough people are talking about. And that is the recent rise in anti-Asian violence over the last month in particular, but definitely since y'all's little former president started his racist and xenophobic foolishness around this time last year. Several videos have gone viral on social media depicting horrible attacks on Asian people and on Asian-owned businesses. The whole most national media outlets have only just begun to cover these issues. We wanted to spend some time breaking down the impact of what's going on with someone from the community who can help us bring a different perspective. So help us welcome researcher, educator, and consultant Bianca Mabute Louis to the pod.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right. So a couple weeks ago, you wrote an article in Elle that helped me find you titled "For Asian Americans, Sharing Our Grief is an Act of Revolution." Talk to us a little bit about what kind of prompted you to write that piece.
Yeah, well, I think internally in the Asian American community, we understand that we've been racialized and experienced racism. But really, in public discourse on race, Asian Americans are usually not in the conversation, right? They're usually referred to, we're usually referred to as honorary whites or model minorities, which really actually erases the diverse ways that we have been victimized by white supremacy, both systematically and also interpersonally in these attacks that we're seeing. So I really wanted to document and write about how I saw a lot of Asian Americans taking up space, a lot of them for the first time, and sharing about what it meant to be racialized as an Asian American. And I was seeing, I felt like this collective awakening and this consciousness raising happening among Asian Americans, again, many of whom who I noticed don't actually usually use their platforms to talk about race, were now being very courageous and forthcoming about how they were processing these videos and these attacks that they were seeing. And I really wanted to write the piece to really preserve what I was seeing into like our collective memory. And I wanted to document the ways that Asian Americans were pushing back against the silence and against these stereotypes of model minority. And one more thing I wanted to also document was the ways that Asian Americans were pushing back on policing as a solution to the violence we were seeing. And so as the media was very much showing and circulating these videos where that felt very sensationalized and where most of the perpetrators were Black, I did not see as much in the media of what I was seeing in the community, which was community organizers, activists pushing back on anti-Blackness as a response to this anti-Asian violence that we're seeing.
One of the things that I found really interesting in your article, which I think, first of all, you did a really, really beautiful job of explaining this entire situation in your piece in Elle, and I would encourage everyone to go and read it. You talked about how, you know, some Asian folks are beginning to break their silence, and I want to read a quote from your piece. It says, in the Chinese language, there is a phrase that roughly translates to eat bitterness or swallow your suffering. You say the term reflects a cultural value, an idea that holding in our grief and hardship is fundamental to our collective well-being. Can you talk a little bit about what that means, where that comes from, and what it looks like in a situation like this?
Yeah, so the term is a Chinese term. In Cantonese, it's pronounced sik fu, which means to basically forbear and kind of keep in your any suffering or struggle you're going through, with the idea that naming our suffering could potentially create a burden on other people around you. And so really, you know, this, it isn't that we culturally just want to be silent. It really comes out of this deep sensitivity and appreciation for the collective harmony and well-being of the group. But again, like any cultural value, there are parts of it that are really beautiful and there are parts of it that can be really harmful. And then situating that cultural value of eating bitterness, swallowing suffering into the context of migration, right? To eat bitterness and to keep pushing and to just keep your head down is also a strategy for survival, especially economic survival. And I don't think that's particular only to Asian folks. And also situating it in kind of the international context and considering the countries where many of our families migrated from or fled from, speaking out at times, particularly about maybe how your country has failed you, could cost you your life or could be really, could have really dire consequences. And so there's a trauma that comes with speaking out. And again, this eating bitterness as a strategy for survival. And so I wanted to write about that because it felt like that nuance was important to frame and to understand just how significant it was that Asian Americans were claiming their voices in this way.
It reminds me of, we did an episode a while ago with Jen Yamato from the LA Times and Jialin Yang from the New York Times. I believe she works at the New York Times. And Jialin in particular, you know, she wrote a book about kind of, I think, the history of Asian folks, particularly in the U.S., and this history of anti-Asian violence that you talk about in your piece, right? How it is not new, right? How it has been happening for centuries, you know, at this point. And how that mirrors, you know, the violences that Black folks have experienced in this country. And it's there's a post on your social media that I saw recently where you talk a little bit about the ways in which Asian Americans are kind of cognizant of both communities' histories, and even though many of these current instances that we've seen of the violence against Asian Americans have been committed by Black people, that there's also kind of a simultaneous pushing back on anti-Blackness that we know is present in so many communities. I'm wondering for you if you could like talk about the ways in which you've seen that anti-Blackness work show up, particularly in the context of what's going on right now, trying to hold people accountable for the violences that, you know, the community is facing, while also not trying to perpetuate, you know, state violence, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. First of all, I think we need to pay attention to the videos that the media is circulating, right? Mm-hmm. I actually am working on a visual sociology paper where we're analyzing every single video that has gone viral of interpersonal attacks against Asians. And the perpetrators, unfortunately, are a diversity of people, not only Black folks. And so, again, it's really important to notice and address how the media is choosing to frame this problem, and also to understand that where these attacks are happening, a lot of times it's happening in working class communities like in Oakland and New York City, where communities of color have already been pit against each other to compete for scarce resources, right? There has been an intentional divestment from those cities and from the communities that live there. And so that's kind of the background of what's happening. And so it's important to realize that, because in framing this issue and in talking to my community about it, I really try to provide the analytical lens that the enemy is not each other, but the enemy is white supremacy and these conditions that we're living under, the scarcity that we're living under. And to always be uplifting the histories and reality of our communities working together. And I think that is an important way to ground us at this time. And, you know, even just taking this opportunity to highlight in Oakland all of the interracial groups that have come together to implement public safety strategies, where people are donating to mutual aid to support the victims, where people are signing up for security walks to escort our elders from place to place, right? There is organizing happening across racial groups to keep our communities safe that don't rely on policing and the carceral system, which we know is inherently anti-Black. And so, yeah, again, just it's important to elevate and center the grief while helping people understand that it isn't us against them. But really, this is about mobilizing all of us against white supremacy and all the ways that white supremacy shows up in our lives, and ultimately building a more robust movement for racial justice.
You said in your piece, quote, as we show up to honor our elders and make our grief visible, we refuse the notion that things can go on as they are. We expose and reject the ways white supremacy attempts to divide and conquer us. And I thought that was really, really important, because I do think that there is this pitting against the races of each other that is not really valuable for either one of us. You also quoted Kathy Park Hong in your piece from her book, Minor Feelings. And I thought this quote was really, really important, so I wanted to pull it forward. It says, "When I hear the phrase, Asians are next in line to be white, I replace the word white with disappear. Asians are next in line to disappear. We are reputed to be so accomplished and so law-abiding, we will disappear into this country's amnesiac fog. We will not be the power, but become absorbed by the power. Not share the power of whites, but be stooges to a white ideology that exploited our ancestors. This country insists that our racial identity is beside the point, that it has nothing to do with being bullied or passed over for promotion or cut off every time we talk." Now, I want to be honest, like, I've heard this idea that Asian folks are as close to white as they can be, and have participated in that, right? And like, sure. As I read this, I felt like, whoa, I'm trash for that. Talk to me about this model minority kind of conversation that always happens around Asian folks and why it's harmful and dangerous.
Yeah, well, first of all, I mean, I think whiteness can be seductive and people make choices to participate in that at the expense of other racial groups, right? That's just the reality and needs to be called out. I think also, you know, that line about Asians being next in line to disappear is really a commentary on the erasure that happens with the model minority myth and the assumption that Asians are honorary whites, that, you know, that stereotype really just serves this neoliberal colorblind racism agenda, that this minority group that did face racial violence and structural systemic barriers was able to work hard enough to pull themselves up by their bootstraps and overcome racism. So why can't everyone else, right? But when people perpetuate these narratives, first of all, it's just not true because systemic racism does exist. And there are ways that Asian Americans experience a very severe wage gap, are victims of ICE and mass deportation. There are systemic ways that Asian Americans are victimized by white supremacy and interpersonal violence. And all of that nuance and all of those needs that our community does have, again, gets erased and absorbed by these stereotypes. And so, again, the assumption that Asians are next in line to be white and to disappear essentially flattens and erases our racial identities, which comes with history, a culture, experiences with oppression, and experiences with organizing against racism, and really just kind of consumes us into this country's problem with historical amnesia, right? Mm-hmm. So again, the all of this depends on us not knowing our history and erasing the diverse ways we do experience racism.
I love the way you framed that in terms of it all being, and the ways that we sometimes participate in these, you know, problematic agendas is rooted in sometimes us just not knowing our histories as a community. And I would go further and say our shared histories as communities. I feel like so often when we talk particularly about like Black communities and Asian communities, you know, the negative or salacious instances between those relationships are often the ones that bubble up to the surface. So, you know, I know here in LA, one of the ones people always talk about is like the killing of Latasha Harlins, right? And how that sowed kind of discord among Black and Asian communities here in LA. But we never talk about the other instances in which Black folks and Asian folks were like side by side in the fight for equality. And I think kind of having that history as something that we uplift as much as we uplift everything else is important for all of us, right? To realize the ways in which we all buy into and are complicit in some of these systems that white supremacy has put before us. Because even us as Black people, right, engaging in, you know, the comments around Asian folks being model minorities and stuff like that is something that, like, that's what the system wants us to do, right? To pit ourselves against each other. And being aware of, like, the history of all of that helps us fight against all of that. I'm rambling now, so I'll shut up. Go ahead, Jared.
Bianca, we really appreciate you taking the time to be here today. We've got the link to your article in our episode notes. We really appreciate your time and your talent for being here today. So thank you.
Thank you, Bianca.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
When we come back, we're talking about why so many Black folks are hesitant to get vaccinated for COVID-19. More Fanti coming up after the break.
Maximum Fun is a network by and for cool, popular people. But did you know it also has an offering designed to appeal to nerds?
A show for nerds? On Maximum Fun, the devil, you say?
It's true. It's called The Greatest Generation, and they review episodes of a television program for nerds called Star Trek. They've reviewed TNG, DS9, and are now reviewing Voyager.
Hey, Star Trek. My daughter enjoys that program.
Well, if she enjoys that, and she enjoys humor of the flatulent variety, might I recommend she subscribe to The Greatest Generation?
Hey, are you calling my kid a nerd? Boy, I oughta...
Well, gotta go! Become a friend of DeSoto by subscribing to The Greatest Generation on MaximumFun.org today!
Does our podcast deep dive into the weirdest Wikipedia pages we can find?
Yes! Do we learn about scam artists, remote islands, horrible mascots, beautiful diseases, and mythical monsters?
Yes, 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 absolutely, and yes. Do we retain any of this knowledge?
Probably not. I'm Emily Heller.
I'm Lisa Hannawalt.
We make art and comedy and TV shows and also the podcast Baby Geniuses. For the past 8 years, we've been trying to learn new things about the world and each other every episode.
But let's be honest, this podcast is mostly about two friends hanging out, shooting the breeze, and making each other laugh. We're horny, we like gardening and horses, and we get real stupid on here.
But like, in a smart way.
Yeah.
Join us every other week on Maximum Fun.
Baby Geniuses, tell us something we don't know.
The COVID-19 pandemic has had some incredibly life-changing effects on all of us, and many of us are eager to get back to life in whatever the new normal will be. Much of that being possible is predicated on vaccines, decreasing numbers of infections, and maybe some kind of a cure, at the very least, good mask wearing. But there are a lot of people who, while they want the pandemic to end, like everyone else, have reservations about signing up to get a needle in the arm. Black folks have some of the worst engagement with the healthcare system of anyone. Study after study has shown that Black people have many reasons they don't trust medicine, hospitals, doctors to give them good, fair, equitable, trustworthy treatment, and it dates back generations. Most people tie this to the United States handling of the Tuskegee study of untreated syphilis in the Negro male, a horrendous experiment by the U.S. Public Health Service and CDC for 40 years, ending in 1972. If you don't know, Google it. The shit is wild, but it's probably why so many Black people don't trust white people. We wanted to talk to two Black medical professionals on their perspective about the vaccine and whether or not we should be getting in line and pulling up our sleeves. They are both joining us now. Emergency physician and ABC News medical contributor, Dr. Darian Sutton, and clinical nurse specialist, Nurse Alice Benjamin. Both of you, welcome to Fan Time.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Hello. This is exciting. Thank you so much for having me.
So I'm going to start with the whole Tuskegee of it all because, you know, I was in some clubhouse rooms a few months ago and, you know, people were talking and a lot of people like to go back to Tuskegee as, you know, kind of the foundation for some of their concerns and issues, right, around the vaccine and, you know, all of this conversation that we've been having over the last year. And then Curtis Lee in the LA Times did a piece a few weeks ago in which he went to Tuskegee and interviewed Black folks, both about the study as well as kind of their general wariness as it relates to COVID. To get us started, and I'll come to you, Dr. Darian, first, as a Black medical professional, how do you think about and address, you know, some of these like very real concerns that Black folks in particular have about whether it's the vaccine in particular or just generally engaging with, you know, the medical establishment?
I think for me, the approach that I take, honestly, is just asking and listening. Every single patient that comes in that requires treatment has different ideas of what they expect and what they would want, depending on what they need. And I think it's the same for vaccines. When people have questions about vaccines, those questions need to be answered, especially in the setting of a pandemic of a novel virus and a new vaccine. It is common and appropriate to ask a question, especially if someone is asking you to use something, to take something, or to eat something. It is appropriate to ask that question. So I think it's necessary to answer it. And so my approach, honestly, is singular. It's basically isolating that patient, talking to that person and figuring out exactly what that specific question is, addressing those myths, addressing the lack of information, if there is any, and then hopefully coming to a resolution where that person walks away feeling educated.
So outside of being a healthcare professional, I'm also a consumer of health, and I am the mother of consumers. I am the daughter, the aunt, the sister, and all of these things. So when it comes to innovation in healthcare, while I am on one side of the fence, you know, being a champion of it and supportive of it, because I want to see people, you know, do better, be better, and feel better, I have to admit, I am too also, sometimes I have my reservations, but it's not because I'm necessarily challenging the science, but I would just like to be an informed consumer. So I'm not saying no to things, but sometimes I'm like, whoa, hold on. Let me, you know, do my research. Let me find out more. Let me educate myself before I move to take a medication or, you know, say to my, you know, sister, like, okay, I think that surgery is okay. And I think that's where we see a lot of people now with COVID-19 and this vaccine. No one wants to die. We all want to, you know, be healthy, live long, prosperous lives. But now confronted with a vaccine, which, by the way, historically, we've never really been like watching step by step by step the creation of a medication. So you're asking a whole bunch of viewers and audience members to now put on their science hat, put on their, you know, honorary doctor nurse hat and understand the science. It's really scary. I mean, even for, and I'm sure the doctor can attest to this, some of the things we do in healthcare and medicine is scary. I mean, we are, you know, changing things using science, technology, medications to literally change lives. And so if you take someone who can't fully understand that science, that medicine and how quickly things move, they would be just as frightened and afraid of new treatments and advancements. And like I mentioned, I am also as well at times.
Mm-hmm. So how do you then, Nurse Alice, go about like having these conversations with your family, with your friends in terms of, and we can make it specific to the vaccine and the COVID of it all. How have you approached and broached, you know, the necessity around taking the vaccine with your people?
Right. So I get questions all the time. I've heard about every, you know, myth story about, oh, well, so-and-so, you know, had problems with their vision. They had this, like, I hear all of these things and I kind of dial it back to say, you know, going over, you know, COVID and the significance of if you get the disease, what could potentially happen. Now let's talk about the vaccine. What are your concerns? And I think most of the people's concerns are, you know, it happened so quickly. Now they just want me to make an appointment. And I think if you just, you know, just slow down a little bit and listen. People just want to be heard, right? Let's validate how people are feeling, listen to them, and address what their questions are. I think what we're seeing a lot of now is just educate, just throwing stuff at people without really having done an assessment of what are their questions really stemming around. And also, I mean, when we look at Tuskegee and, you know, other things historically that have happened, you know, and how they're being treated now, let's talk about it, right. by the healthcare system. I can understand the reservations, but everyone's different. Every story is a little bit different. So listening to what their issue is, their concern is, and addressing that, individualizing what I have to say and how I educate them to what that scenario or their question is.
Dr. Darian, I'm curious about the conversations you were having with other Black medical professionals as we were waiting to see a vaccine come in, and then when one got here, what was there skepticism? What was the feeling there?
My first answer is, what other Black medical? No, it's it's really hard to find. You know, as a Black physician, we compose 5% of the total physician population, and that number hasn't changed since the 1970s. So the availability of Black medical professionals as colleagues is always limited. I do have the fortune of having a twin brother, having a mother who is a nurse, and having close friends throughout medical school, although limited, to have these discussions with. I think we started all in a similar place, which is that area of skepticism. Whenever you label something, which I think it's inappropriately labeled, something like warp speed, that kind of wakes everyone up. That makes everyone pay attention and ask, how is this possible? How is this being done? But after further investigation and really looking at the available data, we were able to come to that decision together that this is something that was going to benefit us, to protect us, and to allow us to see our families again.
I think, you know, when we talk about, I want to recognize for our listeners, right, that we record on Tuesdays, as y'all know, and earlier today, the fool over Texas, you know, removed the ban, or I guess the
mask mandate.
Right, the mask mandate. He removed the mask mandate, and he said all the businesses can open up at 100% capacity. Like a fool. I'm not even a medical provider, child, and that feels foolish to me. and so we see kind of, I think, a different way in terms of like how different states are responding to the vaccine. I've said before on the show, my mom's in South Carolina, and they act like we not in the middle of a pandemic, okay? She been going to work every day for the last year, while we in the rest of the world have been like stuck at home and stuff like that. And so I'm just wondering, you know, what do you find to be like the most important thing to like tell people at this juncture of the conversation? I'll start with you, Nurse Alice, and then we'll come to you, Dr. Darian.
I think we still need to remind people, this is still a world pandemic. We've had over 500,000 people in the United States alone die from COVID-19. And, you know, we have to paint that perspective. But this is the thing. As a healthcare professional, I can say all of these things, but where politicians get it twisted is they're thinking about, you know, the finances of it and reopening the economy, which just indeed are important. But I think there needs to be more of a marriage, more of a collaboration with the healthcare community about how you do these things and to roll it out safely instead of just pulling the sheet off the cover and, you know, letting everybody go. And I think that's one of the biggest mistakes. And it's frustrating. It's really frustrating to me. And I know it has to be frustrating to people who take all the precautions. Like, you have people staying home, not, you know, indulging in, you know, the group activities that they used to do, wearing masks and doing all these things. And you look to the left and then you see states, it's like nothing ever happened. It's really frustrating for people. And I just wish that some of our politicians would be more collaborative with health professionals. Again, we're not saying, no, you can't do it, but let's do it in phases. Let's do it safely. And I think that's one of the areas where if we're not careful, we can find ourselves back at square one.
Dr. Darian, that reminds me, you were in New York at the height of the New York issue, right? Earlier in this pandemic, you moved out here to LA. What are your feelings, your thoughts, your approaches to this current moment that we're in?
So I agree with everything she just said. I mean, at the end of the day, we are still in a global pandemic, and this virus is still very much present. And the actions of people like Governor Abbott, it's just a blatant disregard to those most vulnerable in the communities that he was elected to protect. It's really frustrating for me because Governor Abbott is someone who was vaccinated in December, has obvious access to healthcare as he has full healthcare coverage, and he has access to some of the best medical treatment in the world, obviously, since he's a governor. But that is not the same for many of the people that reside in his home state. And so for someone like him to simply say, oh, no one has to wear a mask, I'll let them decide what their level of risk are, you don't realize that the pandemic is one that requires communication and participation between all of us, because you can't choose whether or not you're being exposed. So that decision that he made today in terms of not wearing masks at all makes something as simple as going to the grocery store a dangerous obstacle for many people, especially for people of color, since people of color are known to die at 2 to 3 times the rate as their white peers. So for me, it was, honestly, my mom's gonna get angry at me for me for saying this, but it's just dumb. It's just the dumbest decision I've ever seen, honestly, throughout this entire pandemic, especially having sat through the height of the pandemic in New York and the height of the pandemic here in LA. And I've watched how the pandemic kind of goes from initial communities of wealth and then transcends to those communities of color. And the communities of color are the patients that are still hospitalized right now in my ICU. So it really is frustrating.
So I want to kind of move into, like, you know, the facts and the information that we want to make sure they get to people. So most recently, we got the Johnson & Johnson approval of their vaccine, and we've seen that rolled out earlier today on Tuesday. We heard from the White House that they expect that there will be enough vaccine for every American by May, which is moving that expectation up 2 months, which is obviously positive information. And we're also, you know, racing against the mutations of this vaccine, of this virus, and trying to get people vaccinated before, you know, those other strains kind of begin to take hold. I'm curious, Dr. Darian, I'll start with you. What are you most concerned about, and what are you most optimistic about when we're looking at the trajectory of the virus right now?
I'm most concerned about being comfortable with where we are right now. I think sometimes when we see these numbers come down in terms of cases and hospitalizations, people feel comfortable and they underestimate the danger of this virus, and they do activities that put them and the people in their community at risk. So I'm most concerned about that. I know that the numbers look great and it feels like you want to step outside, take off your mask and go back to normal life. But it concerns me that maybe people don't realize we are still at imminent risk of having escalating numbers of COVID-19 and people back in the hospital and kind of starting where we honestly just finished. I'm really optimistic about this vaccine. I know that it comes with a lot of skepticism and people have a lot of hesitancy, but I'm really optimistic with the preliminary numbers that we are seeing. Despite the presence of these variants, the numbers of cases, specifically, for example, from patients who are coming from long-term care facilities, has substantially decreased. Right now in my ER, I'm seeing more patients who are symptomatic and younger, and it's more rare to see anyone who's vaccinated come in with symptoms of COVID-19. And just so everyone understands, the people who live in long-term care facilities, although they account for like 1% of the American population, they accounted for over 30% of the deaths. So vaccinating that high-risk group has allowed us to see that incremental benefit in use of vaccines and how that helps stop hospitalizations and deaths. So it really, really it really motivates me and brings me optimism.
Nurse Alice, what are you concerned about? What are you optimistic about?
One of my biggest concerns is that once people get the vaccine, that masks come off, they're out resuming normal, regular activity. And while we know that the vaccine will be very beneficial at helping to prevent them from getting ill from COVID-19, we still don't know yet if that prevents someone from being a carrier of the disease. And quite honestly, we're nowhere close to herd immunity. We have to be somewhere around 70 to 85% of the community to have that. And we're very far from that. Gosh, I think our numbers are, where are we at? It's less than 10% of people who've received both vaccines. So we still have a long way to go. So that's one of my biggest concerns, especially in the summer months. You know, everybody's going to want to get out and travel and do things like that. What I'm most optimistic about is, I have to be honest, I'm really optimistic about the J&J vaccine. I know it is the vaccine that has everyone most skeptical because it only has 72% of effectiveness. But what I like about this vaccine is that when it progressed through its trials, it was subject to many of the variants that the Pfizer and the Moderna vaccine did not go up against because they just simply didn't exist at that time. So, and then also it's the way that it's stored and shipped. It can be stored in the refrigerator for 3 months, meaning that I can put it in a cooler and I can take it out to far out communities or to places where perhaps elderly or disabled people can't come to the vaccination site. So it's something that I'm very hopeful about. And it's a vaccine that also you can get into your doctor's office, right? And so when it comes to Black and Brown people, who do they trust most? They trust, they'll trust their healthcare professional, their doctor in their community. But if I can't get the Moderna and the Pfizer vaccine into my local Black physician's office because they don't have the ability or the equipment to store those vaccines. But the J&J, they can. They can put that in the refrigerator. So I'm hopeful that with the J&J vaccine, that we'll be able to get more people vaccinated because it's a lot easier to transport, to store. And I feel pretty good about the numbers and the fact that it went up against those other variants, which really has many of us concerned right now.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Zarian, I see you nodding your head when she talks about, when Nurse Alice talks about herd immunity and the percentage, right, necessary to get us there. Could you break that down for the people about what that means and actually what that means in terms of how many people need to get vaccinated in order for us to get there?
Yeah, I'm nodding my head because Nurse Alice is hitting everything right on the head. So it's really hard not to. So when we're trying to get to this vaccine-induced herd immunity, a lot of people will look at estimates of how many people have possibly been infected with COVID-19, as well as the estimates of how many people have been vaccinated and try to add those numbers together and then state, well, aren't we closer to that number of 70%? And so I just want to start by saying a lot of our estimates are exactly that. They're estimates based on analytics analytics from similar coronaviruses that have existed before, as well as other viral illnesses that cause outbreaks, epidemics, and pandemics, like the flu, for example. And so what we have estimated is that approximately, in order to get to that herd immunity where we can decrease transmission as much as possible, the threshold seems to be around 70%. And that means that 70% of the population would need to be vaccinated and have a reputable immunity to stop them from being infected with COVID-19. Therefore, it decreases the risk of transmission from person to person and stops the outbreak of this pandemic. What people have to also understand is that once we get to herd immunity, it doesn't mean that COVID-19 goes away. COVID-19 will likely exist in our communities for a very long time, but I think the setting and the idea of what it looks like in the future is very different. For example, I'm up against infectious diseases that once caused outbreaks and epidemics that now we don't see the same way. If you just look at, for example, how HIV is treated, if you look at, for example, how tuberculosis is treated, even, for example, the flu, you know, all of these are infectious diseases that once caused significant problems, but through medications, treatment, as well as vaccinations, we were able to get a hold of them. And I think COVID-19 is going to go in that direction again if we are able to get enough people vaccinated.
One of the questions that is a major thing for so much of our society right now is school. And we're thinking about kids and we're thinking about teachers. Nurse Alice, I want to get some clarity on the debate around whether or not teachers should be vaccinated. Why is it such a question? Because to me, it seems like a no-brainer, but then we also kind of hear that it's not as high-level priority for some folks. Can you explain that?
Well, you know, I actually am a believer that teachers should be part of the groups that are, you know, vaccinated earlier, have the opportunity to, just because of their frequency and the length of time that they're exposed to different individuals. So that's one thing. Now, when it comes to opening up the schools, now children or our youth, you know, they have lower rates of COVID-19. Many of them, when they've had COVID-19, they've been asymptomatic, it's been mild cases. So there's really not been a major, major concern with our youth when it comes to COVID-19. So for teachers to be in schools with this very low risk population, I believe that's, and Dr. Darren, you could tap in. I believe that is some of the reason why teachers have not been catapulted to this higher category of getting the vaccine. But you know, that's not the issue. The issue is that these kids are going home to their parents, to their meemaws, their grandmas, and everyone else that's in their home. So while here in Los Angeles, we are social distancing, which, and I'm a mother. So, you know, I'm dealing with my kids at home, but I'll be honest, I feel very safe with them at home. And I would like to see some other structures and processes in place before we send the kids back to school. Now, let me be very clear. The school is the best place for the student to learn, absolutely, hands down, but not at the risk of their, you know, safety. So I think that we really need to, while we're talking about medical professionals and politicians collaborating, I think the school districts, the school administrators really need to put their hand in this cookie jar and really communicate with all of us to make sure that, you know, that we have enough masks in place, quality masks, that we have the fiberglass for the students, that we have the proper cleaning equipment, that we have the proper staff that's going to be cleaning these things before we get the kids back in school. But to get back to your point, I would love to see the teachers vaccinated because we know it's going to be quite some time before we actually have a vaccine for the kids, because right now it is only the Pfizer vaccine that's for 16 and up. So it still leaves a lot of children and youth without a vaccine.
Dr. Darian, I'm curious. I saw a lot of head nodding and yesing, yesing. Tell me what you're thinking as well.
I just love listening to Nurse Alice. So for me, I agree 100%. I think that as a person who has people that I love in my life that are teachers, you know, a lot of the times when we're asking someone or talking about risk, it really comes down to the person taking that risk. It's not a choice that can be mandated by someone else. So I think we often have ideas of what we think risk should be, but at the end of the day, the person putting themselves in that harm's way is a person that should be making that decision. And I honestly think that teachers are looking not just for safety, but for a plan, you know, to know that if schools were to immediately fully open back up, would there be a plan for surveillance in terms of what is the minimum amount of testing that's going to be ongoing, as well as the PPE and the physical dividers. And then also sick days are obviously going to look completely different. And also, are parents and family members going to be honest about exposure with their children so that they don't expose other children that can then bring those infectious diseases back home to their families? So I think that all of this needs to be on paper for teachers to feel safe, not just the physical PPE, but also the vaccinations, and then also a plan, similar to how snow days work. If we get to a certain percent in the community in terms of testing positivity, will we shut down schools? Will we delay schools? Will we be able to isolate? You know, all of these questions are kind of up in the air, and I think many teachers are wanting to know the answers to them, and I think that they're owed those answers.
Hashtag that part.
Can we talk a little bit about the side effects of the vaccine? Yeah. I know that you, Dr. Darian, have gotten it. I'm assuming you have gotten it as well, Nurse Alice. You have not. Nurse Alice has not gotten it. So Dr. Darian, I'll come to you. You know, the Nignobs are on Twitter and social media saying that people are dying from the vaccine.
Wow.
Okay. Yeah. And I need you to answer the people. What are some of the side effects? Should people be concerned about, you know, death from taking the vaccine?
So the CDC actually just released a report yesterday on March 1st that was basically the VIRS database, which is essentially a database that allows people to participate with their symptoms. And luckily what they found was that there was no significant symptoms or outcomes that were not predicted from this database. When we talk about symptoms of a vaccine, the most common symptoms that one will get is obviously muscle soreness at the injection site. It can also include muscle aches, fatigue, and a sort of a temporary flu-like syndrome. And when we kind of break why that happens, it's for a reason. When you get a vaccine, your immune system is invigorated. It is awakened. It is alive. A lot of your cytokines and antibodies are being produced and made, and that can cause you to feel temporarily ill. And so that is the most common symptom. But what I like to tell patients is that if you're feeling that, that is your immune system waking up, building antibodies to hopefully protect you against a future COVID-19 exposure and infection. Now, there have been no documented deaths associated with the Pfizer or the Moderna vaccine that we know of today. Obviously, as you give a vaccine out to over 70 million people worldwide, you will see events that will come up that likely will be rare, and we're still waiting for those, but we have not seen any specific significant outcomes to vaccine distribution, which is really reassuring.
One of the reasons that we're doing this show right now is because we're kind of getting closer and closer to the period where more and more people are going to become eligible for the vaccine. Can you, Nurse Alice first and then Dr. Darian, talk about what the factors are that go into the ways that people are being considered for the vaccine? I know comorbidity is a word that we hear a lot, what that is, how that factors into people's eligibility for vaccination.
Well, I think a lot of the guidance, especially, you know, from the CDC, is that looking at your most vulnerable people, the most vulnerable population. So that has been kind of our elderly people. I hate to say elderly, our more senior people, people with pre-existing medical conditions. And we say comorbidities, it's just someone with multiple medical conditions, because you can have diabetes, you can have hypertension, but then when you mix the two, you know, it can create other issues and problems. And so we look at who is at the highest risk, not only age and disease process, but like healthcare professionals. We were put at the top of the list because of prolonged and frequent exposure to people who could potentially have COVID-19. So that's who's been prioritized. Now, here's the thing, and you know, I'm in disagreement with this, but I'm not sure what I can do as America's favorite nurse. Hopefully someone's listening will take heed. But some of these governors... These governors, though, because like there's the recommendations that come out, and Dr. Darian, I know you have to be frustrated with this. These recommendations come out, they're rooted in science, they're rooted in the evidence, but then the governors will kind of willy-nilly make a decision to do whatever they want to do in the state. And that's what puts people at risk, especially, and when we look at some of our most vulnerable people, you know, let's look at people who are uninsured, who are underinsured, or who don't have access, who maybe have insurance, but don't have access to quality health care. You know, there's probably so many more, you know, illnesses and people who have existing conditions that we don't know about just because they don't engage with the healthcare system or because they've not answered the survey. And so Dr. Darian was talking about the VAERS, and I think there's a program called V-Safe. Mm-hmm. My understanding is that sorry if I'm going on a tangent, but this is important. But once you get the vaccine, you're supposed to sign up for V-Safe, you know, download this app. And, you know, they're supposed to give you information about what to report. I can tell you, I can count more. how many fingers you got. How many people I know who've received the vaccine, healthcare professionals included, who were not provided that information. So while we are looking at that data information, it's good to look at. I feel like there's a piece of the pie that's missing from that information. So I don't know where the question was going, but I just had to put that in there because I had to tell it for the people.
I've not heard that part of it before, though, about how after you get vaccinated, you're supposed to be participating in some kind of, like, you know, follow-up research or survey.
Dr. Darian, I'm sorry, Jared, because I know you documented your process of getting the vaccine and the little app thingy. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yes.
Absolutely. I think Nurse Alice is completely correct. I think that whenever you, first of all, you're expecting people to have the ability to have a phone. I think a lot of that idea also just falls, basically makes your results biased because it's only going to be the people who are aware. So the reason why I was sharing that on Instagram in my experience, because I knew that many people did not realize that this V-Safe program that we were checking in on our phones as far as symptoms was something that was available. And even people who worked with me had no idea. And so I share that commonly. Luckily, you know, when we look at that V-Safe result, those V-Safe results, not only did we have over 30,000 participants that were currently pregnant and got the vaccine, so we got to have a little bit more understanding of what that looked like as far as data and pregnancy, but we got over 3 million people to participate. And so although the information is biased, it's a large N value, which is why I referenced it. But yes, I absolutely think so. We should continue to share this, especially with communities of color, because we need to understand how this vaccine is doing in these communities. Because we know that medications and treatments can have different effects based off of people's background. So it's really important to understand that. So I document it on purpose. I share the links on purpose because I'm trying to make sure that anyone who even follows me understands that this is available. And yes, many people don't even realize it. But hopefully it continues to get, we continue to get the word out with podcasts like this.
Yes.
Yes. So you mentioned, we talked about Moderna and Pfizer and Johnson & Johnson. should people be like trying to be discerning about like which vaccine they get? I don't think you can choose. I don't know if that's a possible option, but you know, I feel like I read something on social media that was suggesting that like younger, less at risk.
Can I stop people, you? The words that your doctor or your nurse never want to hear you say is, "I read something on social media." I know
Unless it's from us.
Right. But that's where a lot of people is getting their information, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Whether it's right information or it's wrong information. But someone suggested, I don't know who it was, I can't remember, that like younger, less at risk people should be like looking forward to or trying for the Johnson & Johnson vaccine because it's considered less effective than the others and that the others should be reserved for da 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 da. Anyway, Nurse Alice, you've got faces, give me something.
Okay, well, first off, let me say that social media...
Nurse Alice, I'm going to pause you here for a second.
Yes.
The way you asked that question was very much like somebody who came in after seeing something on social media and was like, well, I had heard something about... Go ahead on, Nurse Alice.
Well, listen, I get that all the time. I had heard, is this true? My friend's cousin, right. Auntie told me.
My friend works at the government and they had heard. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, yes. My cousin's sister said da 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 da. But anyways, but I will say this, and no shade to the CDC or NIH, but what I'm saying is they have not done the best job with disseminating information, evidence, and science. So you take health professionals like Dr. Darian, myself, and other influencers who are still rooted in the science. We do use social media as an important mechanism to disseminate to the masses quickly. You know, something go viral real, real quick. So we want the right evidence-based information to go viral.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's one thing. Now, when it comes to choosing which vaccine you're going to get, it's not like going shopping. So you're not going to pick, do I want some Chucks? Do I want these Louis Vuittons? No, that's not how this works. And let me say this, for the people who've gone to get their flu shot, how many times have you asked, well, which kind of flu shot is this?
True.
We've never done that.
Drag me, You've Nurse not Alice.
So fast.
Drag me.
So many facts.
I don't even know which one I got.
People don't even realize that there are four different kinds. Oh.
And I gave you a flu vaccine.
You did give me a flu vaccine on my old show. Which one was it?
It's on your paper. I don't remember, but it's on your paper. Okay, but you didn't ask me. So So I gave Jared a flu vaccine. Uh-huh. Never once did Jared say, well, what kind of flu vaccine is this? No, so we don't ask that. It's only now because we got a front row seat to the show about what's being made. And now everybody is an expert. Oh, well, I want this. And they're looking at numbers. And the truth is, you can't really compare the mRNA vaccines to the adenovirus vaccines, which is the new Johnson & Johnson, because the technology is a little bit different. It was the study was done a little bit differently, done in different places. So I'm the bottom line. This is period. This is what you need to know. Getting a vaccine is going to be very beneficial. It is better that you get the vaccine. Maybe you'll feel a little sore. Maybe you'll feel like a little flu-like, but it's going to be a couple of days versus getting the actual COVID disease and end up seeing him or I in the ICU with, you know, intubated, sedated, and on all these medications. That's the last thing we want. So point is, no, you don't get to go shopping for your vaccine. Just, you know, I would just like for you to get a vaccine. How about that? Boom.
Period.
Okay. Mic drop. Well, I want us to be able to wrap up here. And both of you have kind of indicated about the different ways that that we are hearing different things over a different time. As a journalist, we think about like what we call fog of war during breaking news, right? Like things are going to change, sis. This is what we know right now. Dr. Darian, earlier you were saying like this is according to March 1st, right? Where are the different places that the two of you go to get information that you trust, other than like obviously like the CDC and the NIH and places like that? Dr. Darian, what are some of the places that people should be thinking about when they have questions and they want to go online to find those answers?
I think that there are some great resources that I use from my personal like experiences in the world. So covidactnow.org is one of those websites for me that is one of my favorites because it really is able to break down numbers based off of state, based off of community, and then even like small towns. It basically shows you what numbers we see so far. And that's, for example, how I was able to understand how Texas is doing. And that's why I was so confused why Texas would open up, because Texas is one of those states that's still code red in terms of COVID-19 risks. Another that I love that is honestly shutting down relatively soon is a COVID tracking project. And the reason why they're shutting down soon is because they have been in existence because of the miscommunication and the mysteriousness of the numbers of COVID-19 for most of this past year. But now we're starting to see more accurate numbers as far as what the CDC is putting out, which is reassuring. But COVID tracking project is one of my favorites still. So those are my two go-to websites whenever I'm needed to quickly reference numbers.
Nurse Alice, where are the places that you like to go?
Well, in addition to the websites he's already mentioned in the CDC and NIH, I always like to go to my local Department of Health because I want to know what's going on in my area. Not that I don't care about Texas, I do, and I'll look at those things as needed, but what's going down in ground zero in my neck of the woods? And I think that's what people really need to be, you know, concerned about, because what's happening here in Los Angeles could be different than what's happening in, you know, Miami, Florida versus another city. So really knowing what's going on in your city, because like Los Angeles, we were hit extremely hard. So our numbers were way different from some of the other cities. So Department of Health is something that I definitely go to. And even when you go to those websites, there are several links. And I'll say this, I want people to be very careful with what they look at. Just make sure that you know, don't just go to mycovidvaccine.whatever, you know, because you are seeing some websites popping up with information that's not legit or based on resources. So just be very careful. But NIH, CDC, my local Department of Health, and then some of those other COVID vaccine governmental websites I'll go to. And I kind of stick there just because I don't want to deter too far from the evidence and the science. Mm-hmm.
Last thing I want to ask is for folks that have already had COVID, because millions of people have already had COVID here in the United States, should they be getting vaccinated as well? Should they be getting vaccinated immediately? Should they wait? Like, what's the lowdown there?
That is a great, great question. I think a lot of people are having that question, especially as we're finding out that more and more people have been exposed to COVID-19 than we initially thought. Currently, there's no specific recommendations in terms of timeline for getting the vaccine after you've had COVID. The general recommendation is that if you've had COVID, you should get the vaccine. And the thought process is because there are some groups of people that we haven't been able to delineate yet that have a waning immune response, meaning their immune response in terms of their antibodies goes away, therefore possibly making them more susceptible to a reinfection. And so the recommendation is that the vaccine so far has showed a durable immune response, and that it would be safer to get the vaccine to prevent a reinfection. Now, given what we know, it is very unlikely to get COVID-19 within 3 months after you've initially had COVID-19. So you'll see some recommendations that say to wait 3 months, and that's generally due to supply. We're trying to preserve supply, and we know that you have a low chance of getting COVID-19 again. But if the vaccine becomes available to you and you've had COVID, there's no timeline that you have to follow. You can just get it.
Yep. All right.
So my last question, okay, now it might be a little goofy, FYI, this is my disclaimer. So I turned 30 in the summer, later on in the summer, all right? Should I or should I not be booking my trip to Tulum like everybody else for my dirty 30, you know? I think I know the answer, but for the people out there who, you know, still booking trips and, you know, gallivanting, what are your suggestions as it relates to trips? Oh, Jerry.
Well, and even to that part, right, because your dirty 30s in July and I have travel planned in October. Which one of us is probably going and which one of us should be sitting our asses at home for our 30th birthday?
Or both of us.
I think that July is, you know, a cautious optimism. I do think that we'll probably have more opening up in terms of like going across the United States and likely travel will be increased. But I would definitely be very cautious about booking any trips this summer just because that's kind of our D-Day. We're still waiting to see what it's going to look like. And if you do, I would make sure that you have travel insurance. October, I have a little bit more confidence in. I think that if you were booking a trip during the fall in October, I have a little bit more confidence in that. But again, we've seen surges before, and although we can rely on the seasonality of COVID-19, we have seen spikes in the summer. And so COVID-19 does not give anything about our trip. So we just have to be really cautious when you're making these trips and get travel insurance.
Now, let me say, just going to throw it in there. If you are, you know, if for people who are deciding to travel, because you're going to do what you're going to do anyways, whether you tell me or not, you can tell me you're not going to do it, turn around and do it. So I like to address the people in that room. So the people in that room, I have to just say, if you're going to do it, if you have your mindset on it, even regardless of what I say, you're going to do what you're going to do. Please, please, please make sure you, if you can get your vaccine before you go, ideally, make sure that you have plenty of masks, hand sanitizer, you know, that social distancing. I mean, because you can only control you. And I'll be honest, I've been in the grocery store. I'm like, oh, 6 feet, 6 feet. And so you have to be your own advocate in these situations. You're like, don't go somewhere. It's like, oh my goodness, no one with social distancing. You have a mouth. Speak up. You have to advocate for your own personal health and well-being at times like this when, you know, if people are out and they're going to do what they're going to do, you can still control what you do. So take all of those proper precautions as much as possible. So I just want to throw that 2 cents in there because people are going to do what they're going to do.
And it's true. People will come into the ER when I'm in the middle of a tent treating patients to ask for a COVID test before their trip. And that was during the height of the pandemic. And how I kept my cool, only God knows. But people will do what they're going to do.
Thank you both so much for being here and lending your voices and your expertise to this conversation to our listeners. We really, really appreciate it. Coming up, we are not going to be doing listener feedback this week. We're going to be getting right to dishonorable mentions, but we want to hear from you. You can tweet or post using the hashtag FantiFam. We'll be jumping in and responding from our accounts at FantiPodcast. Make sure that you follow Dr. Darian and Nurse Alice both on social media. We've got their tags in our descriptions. Thank you both so much for being here. We'll take a quick break and we'll be right back. Travell, I know you are a sugarhead.
I am.
Did you eat like bowls on bowls on bowls of cereal when you were a kid?
Bowls on bowls with no milk, okay, and extra sugar.
No milk?
No milk and extra sugar.
You are the person that goes to the coffee shop and adds 100 pumps of anything to whatever drink you're
Period.
Getting.
Yes.
I can't stand you. Well, if all of you out there are trying to cut down on your carbs, your sugar, or the unhealthy food, you might think that you can't eat any of the good stuff anymore. And that is just not true. Magic Spoon has 0 grams of sugar, 13 to 14 grams of protein, and only 4 net grams of carbs, and only 140 calories in every serving. It's keto friendly, it's gluten-free, grain-free, soy-free, low-carb, and GMO-free. Now, I said this last time and I'll say it again. My grandmother tends to hear stuff like that and she says, oh, so there's zero flavor. That's not true. These cereals are really good. Magic Spoon is releasing two limited edition flavors this month. Cookies and cream, which is right up my alley, and maple waffle. Our build your own box with cocoa, fruity, frosted, and peanut butter, along with cinnamon, are all the different things that you can try out from Magic Spoon.
So what they're telling you is whatever flavor you're looking for, they got it, honey. Go to magicspoon.com/fantai to grab the new limited edition cookies and cream, maple waffle, or that custom bundle of cereal to try today. And Magic Spoon is so confident in their product, it's backed with a 100% happiness guarantee. So if you don't like it for any reason, they will refund your money, okay? No questions asked. Be sure to use our promo code FANTAI at checkout to save you $5 off your order, all right? That's magicspoon.com/FANTAI and use the code FANTAI to save $5. Thank you, Magic Spoon, for sponsoring the episode, honey.
As COVID-19 vaccines are becoming available, Americans are eager to learn more, but are frustrated about where to find answers.
That's why AARP is working to protect Americans 50 plus and their families by making sure you have the latest information about the vaccine and the distribution plans in your state.
Just visit aarp.org/vax to learn who's eligible for the COVID-19 vaccine in all states, when, where, and how to get it, and what you might want to discuss with your doctor. That's aarp.org/vax, paid for by AARP California. So as we said, we're not going to really be getting into listener feedback this week because we wanted to spend more time having the conversation about the vaccine. I do want to shout out all of you, though, that have sent in recommendations for Black bookstores that are that offer audiobooks. And I'm going to make sure to include in the description some of the ones that I've gotten so that we can make sure that we share those with you. Time to get into dishonorable mentions. These are the stories or people that have caught our attention this week that deserve a call either for their good or for their stupid. Travell, you want to go first?
Yeah, sure. I only have two things and they're both kind of connected, so I'm going to do them together. And that is, so the Equality Act passed the House here in the U.S., but which is great. For the second time it has passed. I think it's waiting on the Senate to do their foolishness. Last time they did not pass it, and so it's resurrected.
And we gonna see this time.
But in particular, as so many outlets were covering the passing of the Equality Act, nobody thought to interview trans folks about how the passing of the Equality Act, at least in the House, could impact our particular livelihoods, which is, you know, yet again another example of mainstream media being on their bullshit. But in addition to that, in some other bullshit as it relates to, you know, laws being passed, earlier today in particular, I believe it was Alabama, passed an anti-trans bill in their state legislature. And we've seen a number of other states in particular passing anti-trans bills, particularly as it relates to youth, whether it be trans youth in sports or whether it be, I think in Alabama, they basically want to criminalize medical professionals who would provide gender-affirming surgeries to children and to police the ways in which their parents are able to advocate on behalf of those trans youth. And so this is just my message to, you know, we talk a lot about, you know, advocacy and allyship and accomplishship and all of that. You know, this is the time where, you know, you cis motherfuckers, you know, need to step up to be quite frank, to support the work that is being done to ensure that folks basically aren't legislating their transphobia. So I just wanted to bring some attention to that. If you are interested in getting more information, I suggest you follow Chase Strangio on Twitter in particular, a great trans lawyer who was working with the ACLU. And then you can also follow the ACLU of Alabama. I think they're taking the lead on a lot of the work as it relates to these issues. So those are my mentions this week.
All right, I want to give three honorable mentions to three Black gay men who are doing something great. Number one, I want to shout out Malcolm Kenyatta. He is the state representative that is in Philadelphia, and he is now running for the U.S. Senate, and it's a pretty historic run for him to be going for the U.S. Senate. I'm really excited to see him do well, and you've probably seen a good amount of him on MSNBC. If you are a cable news person, he's been making waves lately, and I'm really proud of him. So shout out to Malcolm Kenyatta. If you are out there supporting, you know, queer and left-leaning candidates out there, he's a person that you should probably kick some money to. Next, I want to shout out Justin Q. Williams. He is a Black man who is an interior designer. He's on the new HGTV series on Discovery Plus called Design Star Next Gen. Low-key, I've always wanted to be on that show, so I'm like jealous in a marginal way, but really excited to see.
Is it a new show? Or you said Discovery Plus, which I know is like, you know, that
Discovery
is
new. It's a Discovery Plus show, so they've brought back Design Star, and like a whole new generation of that show is exclusively on Discovery Plus from the HGTV side. So he's in the first episode. Well, he's in the season, and in the first episode, they say he's one to watch. So I'm looking forward to seeing what he does there. And then finally, I want to shout out Jace Barron. Sort of a tangentially friend of the show. If you obviously have been listening to the show for a long time, Shar Jocelyn's been on our show a long time, a number of times. And Jace Barron's her former co-host from their podcast, Kiss and Tell Radio. His screenplay just won a Los Angeles Film Award, and that's a really big deal for him. So congratulations to Jace for winning at the Los Angeles Film Awards.
And we're going to go into our Black History Month segment, because Black History Month is happening every single day around these parts, okay? Cue song, Jordan. Black History is happening every day. That time, if y'all remember, back in the day when Lorianne Gibson, Ms. Boomcat herself, she poured into a contestant who was trying to become part of what would eventually be Danny DeCane, called, her name is Taquita. Take a listen.
As an extra girl. Yay, Taquit. Here we go, ladies. 5, 6, let's rock. Push, drop, left, right. Look for you girls, okay? Look, right, left. 5, 6, 7, 8. Why are you yawning? Oh my gosh. There's no time for that. Like, I'm not even playing with you.
I've had a big problem with me and focusing. Sometimes I wander off, and it's not purposely, because I wouldn't do it on, but I don't like to get yelled at.
Taquita, is there a problem today? Okay. Be conscious of where you're at. Be conscious of this moment. Do not yawn in this moment. Let me hear you guys sing.
So you walked over to me.
Let's go back. Too much. Just like the way it's sung. No, too much neck, honey. 6, 7, 8.
Oh, you just want me to get started.
Again for Taquita.
It's touching my body. Oh.
No, let's go back. What time is it? Can I please send you home now?
So I've never seen this. But I want to fight for Taquita.
Listen. Okay, first of all, my Making the Band heads, y'all know, okay, Making the Band was a early 2000s, I believe, Diddy show on MTV, in which he was trying to make a band. He had a number of seasons. One of the seasons, or I guess it was actually two seasons, led to the creation of Danny DeCane. Which gave us the one and only Don Richard. But Taquita was one of the contestants, and I just love how those old school MTV reality shows used to do the editing with the sound effects.
I was gonna say, the music was so dramatic. I'm like, oh God, what just happened?
I love it. I love it.
And before we go, if this conversation piqued your interest and you want more of this here,
good.
Check out other episodes that may have related to this conversation, including episode 11, Proud to Be an American, that series that we did. This episode was called Proud to Be an Asian American with Jeng Yamato and Jia Lin Yang, both from the LA Times and the New York Times, respectively. It's a really, really valuable conversation. So go ahead and check that one out. We appreciate you listening and tuning in this week. We had a really big show. I know we went a little long this week, but if you enjoy the show and want to help it grow, we ask that you give us a 5-star rating and a review on iTunes. If you have a comment or suggestion, suggestion about this week's show, tweet at us at Fantai Podcast or hit us up on Instagram at the same Fantai Podcast. You can use the hashtag Fantai Fam.
Yes, and if you want to join, become a member of the Fantai Fam and the Maximum Fun family and financially contribute to this wondrousness we provide you all, you can do that at MaximumFun.org/join. As always, you can send us an email at Fantai@MaximumFun.org.
Also, want to mention, we're really grateful for all the folks that are out there buying the merch. We've been getting updates saying that it's doing really well. We've got hoodies, we got t-shirts, we've got a cool sticker. Yeah, we got a mask. We've got all these different things with the Fantai merch. And we're really, really excited about that. You guys have one more week to buy because it is going to be closing after next week's show. So make sure that you go over to the link in our bio. Link in our bio. What is this, Instagram? The link in the episode notes to be able to get the merch before it's gone.
Yes, please do. Okay, you don't want to miss out on this good. Okay, you want to be a part of the group. That first group, right, that said they got the Fantai drip. Okay, that first go around, okay? Just like everybody.
Because you ain't never gonna see this drip again.
Listen, this is just like Ivy Park, okay? I don't know how many times I gotta tell y'all, all right? She not doing the first round of stuff no more. You know, the black and the brown. Now she on to the next one, the white and the pink and the blue and stuff, okay? And so you wanna be
run the first group. Come back.
I'm doing too much?
Come back.
You wanna be both the first group? Okay, y'all, go on.
I just saw you drifting away. I know how you do. Our music is produced by Corice. You can find him anywhere you get your Slayworthy audio. That's Cor.ece. And our graphics and video design, all that cool stuff that you get to see about our show, comes from Ashley Nguyen and the folks over at Moonhouse Creative. Our producer this week is Jordan Cowley and Laura Swisher. This is a production of Maximum Fun.
Period, poo.
MaximumFun.org. Comedy and culture.
Artist owned. Audience supported.
Wow. She said, no, I was just being entertained. Was that not clear? Okay.